Hi, I'm Joe. I'm joined by my good friend Adam, and we're getting reacquainted after 20 years apart. Now, Adam, we've been hinting at this, or perhaps if you're as interested in the topic as we are, we've been teasing this subject for a couple of months now, but we always dance around it, never quite dive into it. But tonight's the night. We're finally going to do it. We're going to turn all of our friends into enemies and possibly one or two enemies into close friends. It's time to talk about politics. And this is an interesting subject because we both used to be raving conservatives. And I'm now a libertarian. And I believe you're a progressive, if I've been interpreting your Twitter feed correctly over the past couple of years. And I think there's some interesting stories there.
Yeah, that's correct. I was a Republican into college, at which point I turned libertarian, but not quite. Actually, I guess just before I campaigned for George Bush's reelection in Florida in 2004. You may ask what a libertarian was doing campaigning for George Bush in Florida. Well, George Bush was paying well, and that seemed to me an important libertarian ideal, the free market.
So whether you approve of them or not, their money still spends the same.
Exactly. So I made so much cash that weekend. And today I knock doors for John Ossoff for free. So there's definitely been an ideological shift there, and really I've just about done it all. I guess the only thing left for me to do is actually at some point flirt with communism, and then I'll have successfully occupied every part of the traditional political spectrum.
You will, as they say in baseball, have hit for the cycle.
I haven't heard that term before. I like that.
Yeah, hitting for the cycle is when in one game you manage to hit a single, double, triple, and home run. Which is hard to do because you've got to come to bat at least four times, which you don't get to in every game. And then you've got the inherent difficulty of actually getting on base four times. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's me. And you were Republican as well. And then you became libertarian like me. And then your growth just kind of stunted. So I'll be interested on hearing how that happened.
I would say my growth has continued along a trajectory of greater insight and depth of knowledge. But I suppose to some poor benighted souls, it might appear as stunted growth. So let's talk about when you were a Republican, because I don't know if we were the same kind of conservative Republicans or not. So I thought we might start with just describing what you were when you were a Republican, what you kind of think defined what you believed at that point, and then we'll move on to the evolution.
Gosh, that's kind of an interesting question. Was I even aware of how many differences there were among Republicans then? I'll tell you, back then, at least in high school and so forth, it certainly seemed to just be an us versus them situation. As recently as that, I became a Republican because I kept hearing really rude comments about Democrats among the family. And I specifically remember, in fact, once overhearing my parents discussing something that the Republicans Clinton did, and the Republicans were the wronged party, and I thought I was being clever. I'm 9 years old or eight or whatever, by essentially by figuring out a mathematical system for who was right and who was wrong. I gave 1 point for every nice thing that the Republicans did or Democrat did, and then, you know, minus 1 point if they did something that was clearly against Christian principles, which I understood in a general way. And after I showed my parents that I had proven that the Republicans did the right thing, they thought that was great and laughed and encouraged me. And then I did it again for the other thing they were talking about, in which Clinton won. And they were mad.
Suddenly it was no longer so cute.
But then eventually I read everything on the bookshelves, and that included Dad's two copies of, well, one copy of each of Rush Limbaugh's books. And I understood in general that Republicans were the Christian party. And then sometime in high school, I think through a columnist in U.S. News and World Report who is no longer writing, John Lott, maybe, I discovered the world of conservative opinion columns. And I found a website called townhall.com that was on the forefront of the ideological hate site movement. And from that point forward, I read literally every article posted on that site for the next X number of years, maybe into college. And of course, the site itself was a clearinghouse for all the most popular conservative columnists in the U.S. that were writing, from Ann Coulter to John Lott to Bruce Bartlett to the late great William Safire to Thomas Sowell, and on and on. So I consumed an awful lot of that stuff, and to some degree I received an education about how things work from it. And to some degree, I just drank very deeply of the propaganda hose. I don't think, in retrospect, that was healthy at all, by the way. I just called townhall.com a hate site. I don't mean that in the technical, in the common sense of the word, or the term. Breitbart, I think, qualifies as a hate site with a thin coat of paint on it. Stormfront.org is a hate site, as is commonly understood by everybody. But I think websites that are intended to keep their readers in a constant state of agitation are hate sites. That's what they do. They get you to hate the other side. It's very much what George Orwell describes in 1984, the 5 minutes hate. Every day you read something just so that you can be angry at these other people. So these days, as much as I can't seem to help but read news articles online and the like, I try to be very careful about curating my feed, not simply for taste, but so that I'm not receiving too many hate waves, if you will. In college, I think sheer logic took me into libertarian territory. I think it's very common for, as you get older, to kind of see the holes in what the previous generation believes. I don't know what I might have read that turned me. I don't think I read anything explicitly libertarian. Ayn Rand doesn't even qualify as explicitly libertarian. She had a thing all her own, even though I love the novels. But the clear inconsistencies of Republican doctrine seemed to me worth abandoning in favor of the ideological coherency of libertarianism. Conservatives were all in favor of the government butting into your life, essentially so long as it was to do something that made a certain demographic comfortable, whereas libertarians were willing to let things that they didn't like happen. And I learned lessons from libertarianism that I keep today. I think it makes some good points. And perhaps, depending on your philosophy, it is a worldview that I still considered flawed deeply, but which I am glad exists in some small measure, because there should always be some advocate for individual liberty making a case, and that's usually one of the first things that people kind of just slap out of the way. I'll stop there. That's how I got to libertarianism. How about yourself?
So, It's interesting. You referred at the beginning to kind of just the tribalism of us versus them. You were a Republican, your families were Republican, so you were against the them of the other side of the Democrats. And I certainly had some of that. You know, I remember watching stuff with my mother on the news, and it was very much, we liked Republicans, we did not like Bill Clinton and the Democrats, and boy, how disappointed we were when that impeachment effort failed, and that horrible, horrible man was allowed to stay in office.
Right? He cheated on his wife. What president has ever done that?
How could you not kick someone out of office for that? It's inconceivable.
Right. A new low in history.
A new low. But when I think back on my own conservatism, what I really think back on is what a staunch law and order drug warrior I was at the time. I have a very clear memory of reading a Tom Clancy novel, probably high school, possibly junior high. Now I'm blanking on the title. I'll just insert a recording 6 days later where I brilliantly remember the name of the novel. But it involved a character who was a Navy SEAL, had a girlfriend killed by drug dealers, and decided to solve the problem by going undercover in Baltimore, I believe, as a wino, and sitting on the streets, killing, as he caught on to them, the various drug dealers in the neighborhood, and the police were noticing a distinct lack of drug dealers in the area, as he tracked down the ones who had killed his girlfriend, and using his SEAL training, quietly disposed of them. Was an interesting novel in its violence porn, and I remember thinking to myself at the time, that is how you solve the drug war problem. We need to quit being such cowards about how we handle this. We've got the special ops guys. They know what they're doing. All we need to do is send them into the American cities and let them clean up the problem. That'll take care of it once and for all. Obviously, I had never heard of the Posse Comitatus Act or the entire concept of civil liberties at the time. But that's my clearest memory of what being a conservative meant to me at that point in my life, was just, we are standing up for law and order, and there are people out there who are scum, and whatever it takes to get rid of them and to preserve the integrity of society, that is what you need to do. And starting from that standpoint, it's perhaps surprising that I ended up as absolutely libertarian as I am, to the point where today I'm all like, let's legalize marijuana, and let's not stop with marijuana. Let's legalize LSD and heroin, too, while we're at it, because it would make the world a better place. And, you know, tonight we're intending to discuss more high-level concepts than specific policies, but I can make a pretty good argument as to why I think that is, why legalizing heroin would indeed make the world a better place, an attitude that would have horrified my, call it, 14-year-old self. So my journey to libertarianism started when my parents were giving me grief for reading A Steady Diet of nothing but science fiction, and even more generally, reading nothing but fiction, and were strongly, strongly encouraging me on our weekly trips to the library to find something nonfiction to read. Anything, we don't care what, just read something that actually has some value to it. So I wandered over to the other side of the library, where all of the nonfiction works were kept organized by the Dewey Decimal System, and just kind of wandered around the shelves looking for anything that would catch my attention. And somehow, in some way, what caught my attention was Milton Friedman's book, Free to Choose, which he wrote with his wife, and went through in a very, I don't know if you've read Milton Friedman or watched any of the videos of him speaking, but Milton has a very, had, I should say, he's sadly no longer with us. Milton had a very, very clear and direct and understandable way of explaining complicated subjects, such that you listen to him or you read him, and you seem surprised that you haven't understood these ideas on your own before. He just, in a very common sense, forthright manner that's not complicated at all, goes into topics. And so the whole book just talks about all the different areas of our lives in which government policies or regulations or prohibitions take away the freedom to choose, and how society would be better off if we each had the freedom to choose in those areas what we were going to do. And I don't remember what came first. I don't remember if the book came first and then the PBS series, or if the book was written after the PBS series, but there was a PBS series that aired, I believe, in the 70s, where he and his wife did 10 or so episodes going through a bunch of different areas and talking about how giving people the freedom to choose would make society better off. And that was the first time I really got exposed to this idea of it's better to give people more choice, not less, and it's better to give people more opportunities to be individuals and to chart their own course than to try to guide from on high what the best course is for everyone. And especially because he was writing from an economics perspective, that really opened up this whole area of exploration for me of learning economics and how economics applies to the world around us. And that was something I kept reading and really picked up once I got into college. You know, at the time I understood nothing about economics, but I figured I'll just find some econ blogs and show up every day and read a little bit of what's being written. And if I don't understand it now, probably eventually through osmosis, I will.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to have been right. I now understand quite a bit. Not to the point where I think I could just walk into an econ course at a college level and ace it without even trying. I would still need to study. There's, you know, there's areas I know better than others, but I feel like I have a very solid grasp of economic principles and can apply that to politics and to a lot of other areas. So you described that you were attracted to the ideological consistency of libertarianism. I would say I went through a period where I felt that as well, but I would now, if anything, describe myself as I'm a libertarian more because of politics of skepticism. My understanding of economics has given me just a very, very skeptical outlook on anybody's ability to plan anything. And so I oppose most government intervention, not necessarily out of an ideological bias against intervention, but more out of just a healthy dose of skepticism that it's even possible to intervene in such a way as to make things better. So that's kind of the crux of my journey to libertarianism. And it's, of course, an area I can get into much more in depth tonight, but not necessarily right now. You said you were attracted to libertarianism because of ideological consistency, but then you, just a short period after that, described it as a deeply flawed ideology. So what happened there? What do you see as libertarianism's flaws, or what did you see that kind of started pushing you in a different direction?
Well, much like Christianity, ultimately what happened is I got more information. Libertarianism is attractive because it's coherent, but that doesn't mean that it's an accurate map. And when you compare the map to the territory and see that the map isn't taking you where you want to go, then you have to start either making excuses for the map or you start doubting it. I think a number of things.
If I can interject here, it might be useful because I know libertarianism can mean a lot of things to a lot of people and sometimes mean absolutely nothing to other people. So when you say that you are libertarian in libertarianism, what are you thinking of as not a full in-depth explanation, but just kind of what's your view of what libertarianism is?
Oh, that's a good idea. Because obviously there are many kinds. There's the Libertarian Party members who actually have their cards, and then the ones who call themselves voluntarists, fitterists, and everything else. I used to listen to Free Talk Live all the time, and that was always interesting because there were a dozen different opinions on there.
Only two people on the show.
Yeah. Although they often had guests and people calling in and so forth. Still a great program. I think the basic position of an ideal libertarian society works that, you know, basically the government serves as the referee. And only applies force to the degree that is necessary in order to preserve property, including the bodies of the people, of its citizens. And whether or not the government is meant to preserve contracts and people from external threats, which is to say there's simply an army, or whether that includes police, you know, which is something libertarians disagree on, whether there are is an open question. Obviously, you become an anarchist or something of the like if you don't even think there needs to be a government. So there's always a government in libertarianism. It just keeps itself small. Much smaller than Republicans do. The libertarians' government certainly does not care to make social rules, you know, and would probably decline to issue a verdict on whether or not you are married, although it may provide a court in which to decide whether or not your contract with your spouse says you're married. So that's the basic framework. And if you're to the right or left of that, not ideologically speaking, but metaphorically speaking, I don't think that's a big deal for purposes of the discussion. Perhaps you do.
No, I think that pretty accurately sums up what can be a quite tangled and complicated map, because I think the fewer adherents a philosophy has, the more bitterly the adherents tend to argue over what the philosophy actually is.
Oh, and very much, yes. The smaller the kingdom, the more the tyrannical the king.
Exactly.
Okay, but back to what led me away from libertarianism. I do think that my deconversion from Christianity had something to do with it, because once you have a different understanding of human nature itself and the cosmos, then obviously that's going to factor a lot into your political beliefs. And that's one of the reasons why Democrats and Republicans tend to have an issue cluster, because you know, it's an open question as to how much the chicken comes before the egg. But you know, once you believe in one thing, you probably believe in another, and then so forth and so on. Beyond that, I got married. And while I do not have children, I did realize early on after getting hitched that if there was no food in the house for my wife, that I was going to take a gun and stick someone up. That my highfalutin concepts of property would at some point cease to come into it, because I was not going to lose her. I think going to other countries had a serious effect on my views, because when you see, you know, much as the Republicans laud the 50 laboratories that supposedly exist in America for government, there is a lot of experimenting you can see in the rest of the world. And Americans, for all their differences, are also a very similar people. Whereas in the Far East, for example, there are many preconceptions we have in the U.S. that simply do not exist over there, and that's really interesting. And once you see these other ideas put into practice, you can reject them or accept them as you will. And Korea definitely had a strong influence on my ability to see what was possible. It's a far more communal society. Obviously, there's a whole lot of stereotypes about Asia, but stereotypes do come from somewhere, and it is a much more community-oriented society. In fact, every society used to be more community-oriented. Technology in the 20th century really changed the world. I think there are clear parallels, actually, in Western society for everything that we find bizarre about the East or the Near East and so forth. It's just that we don't recognize them. But if we think, we can probably figure out how the Westerners do it. Even to something very small. I recently was struck by how the Southern tendency to call an older person Mr. Blank, where the blank is the first name instead of the last name, is actually now kind of janky. Descendant of more formal half titles that they still kind of have in Korea. You know, different levels of formality. There isn't just Mr. Voli and Adam. There are steps between. And I think Mr. Fred and Miss Jenny kind of fills that. So stuff like that. And of course, it used to be that you did not call an old person by his first name at all. That was only 100 years ago. So as alien as it seems today that there is such a rigid social structure in Japan or China, this was not a long time ago when our structure was just as clearly navigable. It's only recently that things have become more atomized. Where was I? Okay, so yeah, so three things I think I've identified. Change in religion, change in my own life, which is to say getting married, and third, traveling the world and increasing and broadening my experience.
So I would say libertarianism is defined largely, well, not defined, characterized might be perhaps a better way to say it. One of the characteristics of libertarianism is that the government should be as small as possible, as close to non-existent as you can possibly get, that people should have the maximum ability to order and structure their lives the way they see fit. And this is often portrayed as a very rugged individualism, every man for himself. But I think that's a gross oversimplification of the view. I think it's more an understanding that you should be able to form any voluntary community or group culture that you want to without others stepping in to say that you can't. And it's a defining characteristic of libertarianism that if you don't like it, you can leave and you can join up with a different group of people that has formed a different kind of community with a different kind of culture, but that each of those communities is free to exist without interference from the other. And that's where you get the government should be as small as possible because we shouldn't have a central group of people who sees it as their job to go around meddling in what everyone else does. So reacting against that, now that you are no longer libertarian, what do you see the role of government in society?
Well, let me explain what I think is...
And I'm now thinking that may come off as an abrupt question, perhaps even a very libertarian question to ask, but I'm kind of assuming that if you're moving away from libertarianism, you're moving away from that idea of not having government and towards an idea of that there is a role for a government to play. And so that's where the question is more coming from. Not why do you want to meddle in everyone's lives, Adam, but more just what role is it that you've come to believe that government should play in society?
I see. I think that the government should safeguard our lives, our liberty, and the pursuit of our happiness, Joe. And let me cast And so, yeah, I don't have a revolutionary idea of democracy, in fact, or the government. What I think, actually, is that our government has to account for the people that it is governing in order to properly function. I still love liberty. I still believe in a sort of inherent morality to the free market, and in its sense that it's an aggregate of so many voluntary decisions. But I think that now that libertarianism is a utopian idea, let me go back a little to back when we did agree, and cast off from that. When we used to criticize communism, or Democrats who we were accusing of being communist, we accused them essentially of not taking account of human nature, of envisioning this perfect world and then working their way backward rather than accounting for the world as it is. The big perfectly valid criticism is that communists severely misjudge human nature. If there is neither carrot nor stick, people are less likely to strive. And the last good contribution that the Republicans had to offer was the idea that businesses function better with more leeway, capital, larger prizes. It was so clearly of a winner of an idea, actually, that in the 1990s, the Democrats adopted it. The problem is that libertarianism also misjudges human nature. People who fail are not simply not trying hard enough. They're not going to succeed if you give them a larger carrot or a larger stick. It does not account for this as a rule that you just apply. It does not account for the advantages that the children of previous winners have over the children of previous losers. If nothing else, sheer math stipulates that there are winners and losers. And while the market is not a zero-sum game, neither is it infinite. And losing creates desperation. That desperation, which takes the form of poverty and oppression, destabilizes society by creating the many ills that we know today, such as crime. So what I think democratic socialism, if you will, provides is a floor for all that. It harnesses the power of a market in which people make voluntary decisions, but it prioritizes the market in its proper place. It continues to protect life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because if the referee, that is the government, does not at some point blow the whistle and say, hey, he's down, then it becomes bloody gladiatorial combat. And I think that's where Republicans, libertarians go astray. They took the free market as and instead of making it a motivator, they made it a religion. Because when you prioritize the free market's so-called decisions over everything else, then the free market is your god. It is your number one priority. It is mammon. whereas Democrats still believe, say what you will about them, but Democrats still believe that there are other things that matter more than how much the stock market goes up every quarter. And this was actually crystallized just this past Tuesday. You may have seen my tweet about this, but there was a short question, I think, toward the end of the debate when the moderator says, okay, really quick, what's the one thing you'll never budge on? And Karen Handel, the Republican candidate, says taxes. And what she means, of course, is money. Whereas John Ossoff said voting rights. Now, he could have said just about anything other than taxes and still have had a better answer than Karen Handel. because access to our government, the ability to take part in our decision-making process, is a human right. He could have said equality. He could have said any number of things. Money, however, was what was going to play to Karen Handel's base. And I think when that's your primary concern, you have a serious problem. A person does not have liberty. And a lot of this is, and we'll get to maybe like the dead letter constitution versus the living document, for example, later. But a lot of previous conceptions of what life is like are outdated, so that you have, you know, what if all the white people who have had 200 years to establish economic dominance make the voluntary decision to only associate with each other? Then the pursuit of happiness is infringed upon for black people, because they cannot take part in the marketplace. What if the schools are all voluntary and private schools, and that there is no level playing field ever available for the poor child of immigrants to compete against the rich child of a CEO? People laughed and made their normal comments when they said, when Germany declared the internet to be a human right. You don't need the internet to survive. No, but you do need it in order to compete in the free market. That's just necessary. So what I am saying is that I am a fan of the free market. I'm as libertarian, a democratic socialist as you're going to find. But I want everybody to have a chance in it. And I don't want the penalty for losing to be death or a situation that makes a person desperate and causes destabilization, quite aside from whether people are endowed with an inalienable right to life and so on. It's still just bad for society. This is probably the point at which I should be quiet, because we often have a tendency to just keep talking to fill air. And I think I've made my point.
Yeah, I've been sitting here, since our audience can't see me on camera as you can, I've been sitting here with pencil and pad, jotting down notes, much as you see debaters doing while their opponent is talking. They're scribbling furiously. No one's ever quite sure what they're scribbling, but they're scribbling. And for me, it's a whole bunch of points that I would like to return to in depth. I don't think tonight is quite the night when I want to return to them in depth. So I think I'm going to content myself with just laying down a marker to say I agree with 50 or 60%, maybe 80% of what you just said. I think I disagree with some core assumptions, and it would probably be a lot of fun to argue about those core assumptions at a future point. But for now, I'll leave them. I just want the audience to be clear. My silence does not in any way mean that Adam has left me stunned and speechless. you know, as you commonly see claimed on tweets, he was left stunned. Not so much.
And I would like to be clear that what I'm in fact drawing here is actually a caricature of Joe and not any notes at all. Got a little arrows in him and everything.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I know I touched on a little pieces here and there of policy, but I just meant, you know, to give examples of what I'm saying.
No, exactly. And I think it's some of your underlying philosophical assumptions that interest me more than specifics of policy, although I'm always happy to argue policy.
I will be happy to hear, and I know that this was actually a cornerstone of our Theocrats website a while back, but I would enjoy talking with you about how your Christian worldview intersects with your political worldview, if that's within the realm of what you want to discuss. If not, we can save that for episode 5 of this conversation.
No, it's interesting you bring that up, because that was actually where I was going to go next, was that it seems, if anything, your view of human nature has gotten bleaker since your deconversion to Christianity, or maybe your view of human nature is exactly what it always was when you were a Christian. And what I'm referring to is the Christian belief that man is inherently corrupted. I think evil is maybe too strong of a term, but man is corrupted, man is bent and crooked, and needs the saving power of God to be made whole and to be made where he and she can live in a community of people and actually get along together, that in our state without God, we can't live together, that we're inherently selfish and inwardly focused. And so it almost seems to me a Christian perspective of the world to look at society and say, without a government to step in and lead and provide a floor and a safety net and a modicum of assistance, that people are going to be left bruised and broken and bleeding and just dying out on the margins of society. I don't know if you would agree with that characterization, but that was kind of what jumped out to me a little bit as you were talking, is that your view is, if we have just a market without government, the end result is everyone's going to pursue their own ends, leave others who are less fortunate behind, and just leave them to die and be eaten by the wolves.
I think that we have plenty of evidence to back up that assertion. I would agree with that. I would also say that in the view of conservatives and perhaps libertarians as well, I'm not sure, there is a Deuteronomic idea, which Jesus was against, but which is very strong in the Bible and the Older Testament, that essentially, since everyone's fate is decided by God, and that being good naturally gets you where you want to go, that the Lord blesses those who do right. And consequently, those who do poorly deserve it. No matter what happens, if they had just worked hard enough, if they hadn't taken time off, or if they had, you know, done three jobs instead of two, that they would be as rich as Warren Buffett or what have you. And my understanding of human nature now is that that is not true. That people get depressed, the random, infinite number of factors all interacting together, it does not allow everyone an opportunity. And that, consequently, this divine worldview that I had when I was a Republican, and I think I have when I was libertarian, is flawed. So that opportunity must be created artificially, because it will not come otherwise.
I'm thinking of how to put this.
Screw you!
I don't Sorry. See a place in your worldview, and maybe you just haven't expressed it, but I'm going to go ahead and point it out. I don't see a place in what you've described so far for voluntary association, for community help outside of government. Because I would agree with you that it's a lot more than just, if I live a righteous life, God will bless me. If I'm poor, that means God hasn't blessed me. That means I haven't been living a righteous life. I would agree that success and failure is a lot more complicated than that. And there is an element of random chance, and there is an element of what year you were born in, who you were born to, what color your skin is, what state or neighborhood you reside in. There's all these complicated factors that come into play. But my worldview would say there's an element in which members of the community feel a common bond and look out for each other voluntarily, whereas what you seem to be describing is more of a wholly market-driven thing, where everyone's so busy running forward that no one's looking behind or around to see if there's anyone that needs assistance.
Well, obviously, it's not either or, it's both to no small degree. I think the evidence is around you, however, and this depends to no small degree on the culture, but I think it's clear that while people understand that my that they are in fact their brother's keeper. There is also a competing and very strong, even overcompensating, sense of self-preservation. And so they do not do as much as is necessary. Again, if the world is our evidence room, I think that is clear, that not enough is done. In order to do enough, and I think you see this reflected in the tendency of people to consolidate corporations and so forth, something larger is more necessary. And in fact, as much as we, you know, speak of how the tycoons of the 19th and early 20th century forged this continent, there was a lot of government support involved, or else things like the railroad would have gone a lot more slowly. If you want to say it's messy, I agree. The government is a very large hammer. But sometimes you need to move mountains. And the cost of not having the government do it is an atrocious amount of human life. So you're right in that people do voluntarily commit to charity, but it's not enough. And what is more, I would argue that if they stopped giving to charity and just all agreed to, you know, a living minimum wage and a social safety net, that they would do far more good. They want control over their assets as much as possible, and this conflicts with their desire to do good.
So this is where I think I'll jump in and talk a little bit more about the specifics of where I'm coming from with libertarianism, because I think you've given me the perfect jumping off choice or opportunity, which is that if we had a larger social safety net, if we had a minimum living wage, we'd be much better off. And that's where my politics of skepticism really starts to come in, and where my study of economics over the past, let's call it 15 years, make it a nice round number, we'll say 15 years, starts to play into things. Now, I think when most people hear me say economics, they're thinking money. They're possibly even primarily thinking stock market, finance, capital, stuff moving around. And that is not at all what I mean when I refer to economics. I've learned a lot from Russ Roberts, who was a professor at George Mason University, and within the last year or two left that position to dedicate himself more fully to teaching the broader public about economics. And what he likes to say and repeat over and over is that economics, and I'm quoting from a recent book of his here, economics helps you understand that money isn't the only thing that matters in life. Economics teaches you that making a choice means giving up something, and economics can help you appreciate complexity and how seemingly unrelated actions and people can become entangled. So that's what I'm thinking of when I think of economics, is primarily that idea of making choices and choosing between trade-offs. And when you're choosing to have one thing, you're intentionally or not, whether you're aware of it or not, you're choosing not to have something else, that there is always something gained in a choice and something lost, and that you need to be aware of what you're gaining and what you're giving up so that you can be sure you're making the best decision possible. And a lot of my skepticism comes from my belief that most people aren't fully aware of the cost of their choices. They're not aware of what they're giving up. They're not aware of the complexity that's going into the decision. They're not aware of the long-term effects. And so what seems attractive on the surface or in the short term doesn't actually play out well in the long term. And two things that really drive this, two things that I've read and thought about a fair amount. Frederick Bastiat's essay from, going to say, the mid-1700s, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen.
Oh boy, that's a name I haven't heard in a while. Please continue.
Yeah, it's an essay I absolutely love. It's available online, and I'll put it in the show notes for anybody that's listening that would like to read through it, because it's one of those that, once you've translated it from the French, is, I think, very straightforward and easy to understand. But his basic argument is that in any situation, any choice, especially a choice where you're making a decision of how government should allocate resources or how private individuals should allocate resources, that there's that which is going on that you see that's clear and plain and obvious, and then that which you're largely unconsciously unaware of. And the example he uses to lead off his essay is of a candle maker in Paris whose son has just broken a pane of glass that's in the shop, and now he needs to pay 6 francs to the glazier to make him a new pane of glass. And he's, of course, angry at his son who has broken this glass. He's chewing him out publicly. There's a crowd of bystanders, as there would have been in Paris at the time. And all of the bystanders are nodding in sympathy, both with the father and with the son who's getting chewed out. And they're reminding the father, but you see, this is how the world works. For in your need for new glass, you buy glass from the glazier, who receives 6 francs of income and is then able to spend it elsewhere in Paris. And this is what makes the economy go around. This is what makes us all richer. And Bastiat says, I agree. Yes, as the glacier earns his 6 francs, he is better off than he was a day ago. He has sold another pane of glass. He's doing better. That is what is seen and what is obvious. What gets missed is the candle maker now has the use of a window. But that's exactly what he had yesterday. He had the use of a window yesterday. He has the use of a window tomorrow, but he's 6 francs poorer off. And more to the point, his shoes are worn out and he needs a new pair. And he'd been on the verge of going to the cobbler and ordering a new pair of shoes with that 6 francs, and now he doesn't get to, and so he's made poorer off by one pair of shoes that he no longer gets to have, and Paris as a whole isn't richer, because if that 6 francs had not gone to the glazier, it would have gone to the cobbler instead. Either way, it's 6 francs spent, so Paris as a whole is actually worse, because the net sum spent is the same, but now the cobbler is without shoes, or without a new pair of shoes, and that's what you're not seeing. That's the unseen that is missed. And then Bastiat goes on to apply that to a range of economic policies that were in play at the time in Paris, of you can make an argument for an economic policy of this is what we should do to make Paris, or to make France, or to make just certain individuals better off. And it's true, those individuals will be made better off, but you have to keep your eye also on what's happening on the other side, the negative impacts of those policies, the unseen that is all too easily missed because nobody's looking at it. Everybody's got their attention turned in one direction. And so just that idea of always being watchful for what is the other side of a given policy? What's not so easy to see? What do you maybe have to go digging around a little bit to find has given me a skepticism towards various government policies that when we get into particulars, we can definitely talk about. But the general idea is there. The second big one is, I believe this was originally a speech that Friedrich Hayek gave and then was reprinted in the American Economic Review in September of 1945, a speech called The Use of Knowledge in Society.
Someone has prepared for this.
I was just getting a few links, making a reading list for when the girls get a little bit older.
Please continue.
They'll thank me for this later, I'm sure.
Said monk.
But Hayek talks about the uses of knowledge in society and starts out by saying, what's the problem we want to solve when we're trying to construct a rational economic order, how we should order society? On certain familiar assumptions, the answer is simple enough. If we possess all the relevant information, if we can start out from a given set of preferences, and if we command complete knowledge of available means, then all that's left to us is to use knowledge, is to use logic. We can just sit there and figure out, this is what we've got, this is what we need, this is how we're going to get it done, and so we have a certain amount of wealth in society, we have poor people that need to be helped, how best do we help them? This is just a matter of logic. We can solve this. We can do this. But then he goes on to say, the peculiar character of our problem is determined precisely by the fact that the knowledge of the circumstances of which we must make use never exists in concentrated or integrated form, but it's all dispersed bits of incomplete and frequently contradictory knowledge which all of the separate individuals possess. So we don't have the complete knowledge that we need in order to use logic. All that knowledge never exists in one place at one time. That knowledge is scattered all around and held different pieces of the knowledge by different individuals. And so it's a problem of how do we get enough knowledge in order to make the right decision that makes the greatest number of people the best off. And Hayek's argument is essentially, we can't, or at least certainly government can't. Some of the knowledge that's needed is what resources are available, where they are, in what quantities, and it would seem like that you could gather through surveys, but then another part of the knowledge is people's preferences, what, you know, given choice A, B, or C, which would you prefer? And some people prefer one and some people prefer another. And someone who is trying to plan out a course of action can never know all of those preferences in enough detail to be able to craft a policy that's going to work really well. And so when I look at specific government policies that people want to do to make the poor better off, that's really what I zero in on is, as Bastiat said, what is seen, what are we trying to accomplish, and what is unseen that's going to be our ripple effects? And then as Hayek says, what information do we need in order to construct this policy, and is it even possible to get that information? And then there's a whole third angle I could go into, don't necessarily have to on this conversation, of are the people that are even making these decisions really the people that we would want to be making these decisions, and are they going to make them in a way that we would idealistically hope they would? And so what it comes down to is I'm not opposed to helping people. I want to help people. But oftentimes I look at the specific proposals that are being made and don't think they're going to come anywhere close to doing what anybody wants them to do. And so I often end up saying, no, my position is this is a bad policy and it's going to misfire for a whole series of reasons. And so I want the same outcome as you. I want people to be supported, to have that floor, to not be crippled just because of misfortune, but I think the particular policy you're proposing is not actually going to do what you think it's going to do. And to the extent that we carry this conversation on for another 20 hours, I think that's where I'm always happy to dive into those details of, yes, but are we really making people's lives better?
Let's put aside any application to particular issues a little while longer, and also I think that common ground is something that everyone agrees with, at least vocally, which is not to say I doubt your particular commitment. This, I'm very familiar with and sympathetic to the argument that the farther removed a person is from a particular situation, the less likely they are to understand and to adequately analyze that situation. And the person who is on the ground, the soldier on the ground, if you will, has more real-time information, which is the whole free market, is part of the free market idea, and it goes back to the Soviet Union's disastrous attempt to micromanage all of these interactions that it really had a hard time doing. People throwing up the ladder, the question, the command chain, the question of what color they should paint their tractors, when in fact they should have just painted the tractor and gotten on with the situation. I forget the actual genesis of that particular example, but it's a common one. However, this drawback that you mention is understood. I will say a little bit more. I will also add that I understand that the alternative negative scenario to libertarians doing nothing when a solution is necessary is for bureaucrats to micromanage a situation into an untenable one. In fact, we are awash in so many industries these days and so many services with administrators in education, for example. Teachers are having the life choked out of them. However, as a principle, that is understood and across the world, and nobody thinks it's a problem when, for example, either the military does it or a corporation like Apple does it. They understand that individuals are assigned different levels of oversight. The soldier has certain orders to follow, but also understands that he is allowed to fire at will when his lieutenant says so. But he doesn't get to choose which region he goes to, or which town. Similarly, the salesman at your Apple store either, goes off script to some degree, perhaps, but has the basic script given to him by the manager. There's a rollout plan, a particular day is chosen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to belabor the point. But organizations are clearly effective. The ones that, and the free markets argument that a government is not a corporation is, of course, that the government has a monopoly and can't go out of business. Which is true. However, the government's weakness in this respect is due, exactly that. It's an opportunity cost. It has that weakness because it has a job that other corporations don't have. And these things are not, as far as I can tell, separable. The government has a unique mission, and at its scale, a unique role to play that it can't pass off to private actors. I suppose that would be where the point of contention is. You think that it can be passed off to private actors. But in answer to that, I would point again to the world itself. There are many situations that the government has been able to solve that other private actors cannot. You might argue, well, within a certain amount of time, slavery would have ended in the South, you know, for example. In the long run, Mr. President, we are all dead, is what someone once said to Calvin Coolidge. And also,
I think it was John Maynard Keynes.
Possibly so. Now I'm curious. Do look that up if you're going to. Also, it's not necessarily true. You're projecting. Again, you're working backward from this world that you're imagining. A good example of this is the tragedy of the commons. This is a situation that only the government is qualified to deal with. And also, I think it is protection of people's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Even though, you know, no particular private actor has a strong motivation to save the planet on its own. You might argue otherwise, but I write corporate biographies for a living. they don't let me put in the bad stuff, but employees are remarkably forthcoming when they to writers, perhaps because they know that whatever is going to be said will be edited out if it doesn't meet approval. It has been very much established that just as there are bad governments, that private actors, regardless of how much people will frown at them in if it's ever found out, are perfectly willing to kill us for short-term profit. Again, I'm running on, though. I think I made my point.
Yeah, I think you did. I think we're circling around our key points of disagreement here, which is that I'm a lot more skeptical of government's ability to get stuff done and a lot more hopeful about government's ability to ensure that stuff gets done. You know, when it comes, you mentioned teachers being strangled by administrators as just one example of an area in which things aren't running as well as they could be. And I find it not interesting, it's perhaps inevitable, interesting that we're on separate sides of education policy, that I would favor a good bit of school choice and you would not. And I would say, you know, an education is something everyone needs in order to be successful in this world. You cannot be successful in modern Western society if you grow up without an education. And so we need a way to ensure that everyone is getting an education. So I think we would be in agreement there, you and I, and where we would part company is I would say there is no need for state and local governments, primarily local governments in the U.S., to be running schools. There is no need for a school that is government-owned, government-administered, government-directed. There's no need for that. Government's primary responsibility, we could say, is to ensure that every American is schooled. But that schooling could be provided a lot of different ways, by a lot of different methods, other than having a single local school district that is controlled by elected political officials and directed by a single large school board. And so I would argue for government providing funding for education, but government not directly providing the education. And that's where I think you and I would disagree at this point.
That depends. Are you suggesting something similar to the explosion of contractors that we have now in the military, private companies that are charged with carrying out government initiatives?
I'm referring to a lot of different possibilities, and I think that's where I'm, perhaps as a libertarian, it's natural to say this, perhaps not, I'm agnostic a little bit on the direct means, other than to say I think government-owned and run schools are a bad idea, but as opposed to what should replace them, I'm almost agnostic. I think there's a lot of stuff we could do and we could experiment with. We could say, here's a thing that needs to happen, we're going to contract it out, much as happens in the military, where it's like they're soldiers in all but name, and they're actually employed by a private contractor who has a government contract to go in and run whatever province in Iraq. I could see doing schools that way. I could see for-profit schools. I could see non-profit schools. I could see all kinds of different organizational methods other than what we have. But that seems to be a common point of contention between libertarians and non-libertarians, is I see a lot of non-libertarians that are really strongly wedded to the idea of government-run schools, and the disagreement is less over that and more over who should be running the government-run schools.
Well, I suppose it would get well into the technical to say that the idea that government-run schools are bad seems to me disproven by what seems like a generally accepted fact that the best schools are currently in democratic socialist countries, by which I'm referring to Scandinavia. But keeping it in, insofar as the abstract's concerned, I think part of the libertarian ethos is this idea, correct me if I'm wrong, that all people being equal, all their decisions are equally valid, not in results necessarily, but in their integrity. And there's a sort of disinterest in questioning that. It's really part and parcel of this whole idea that only a parent knows what's best for their child, which, if you believe that, talk to either a teacher or a child behavior psychologist, or, anyone else. It's not true. There are, it's a touchy feeling idea that's not based, I think, in concrete reality. Obviously, the parent occupies the position that the apple salesman or the soldier does, which is to say that they are the boots on the ground. But the larger community has a role to play in that, and I think that the wisdom of the larger community helps inform children's development, not to mention the role that the community has in safeguarding children. So regardless of whether we're talking about contractors with a rigorous government program, which does exist in those Scandinavian countries I mentioned, actually, they are stunningly, regulated. it's practically not private school at all, except, and in fact, in Korea, I worked at one. This might interest you, but my middle school was run by Kumho, which is the mega corporation that runs Asiana Air. And in fact, the only thing that would make this clear is the swish of the Asiana Airlines logo, which appeared on pins and various other places throughout the school. And that's a weird relationship. But essentially, the corporation powered the school with this money, and it ran according to government guidelines. Yeah. So. I'm not entirely opposed to private schools, but I am opposed to the idea that, extremely, for example, religious people should be able to isolate children until there is no hope of convincing them that angels who sinned against God were born with black skin and angels who upheld God were babies born with white skin, or that, to use an example from our own past, the world is only 4,000 years old. I mean, I could have been a paleontologist, Joe. That was stolen from me.
Opportunities missed.
Exactly, right?
They'll haunt us forever. I think if I'm going to maybe ding both sides here, I'll try and see if I manage to hit both sides equally. I would say the failing of the libertarian is to judge government too harshly.
and to see nothing good that government can do. Whereas it seems to me the failing of the democratic socialist is to fault individuals too much and to fear unchecked individualism more than they should.
Well, I think they stem from the same impulse, which is a fear of lack of control.
Yes. And that brings me back to the document I was reading right before we started our conversation tonight, which is another one from Friedrich Hayek. I believe it's excerpted from one of his books, may have also been a speech he gave on why I am not a conservative, which I have an interesting history with, because at the time I first heard of that document, I still considered myself a conservative, or I considered myself a libertarian, but with such strong sympathies towards conservatism that I might as well still have been a conservative. And so I heard the title. I knew of Friedrich Hayek at that point. I knew of his stand for free market economics. And so then I heard his title, Why I Am Not a Conservative, and I was deeply offended. I am a conservative. I am a Republican. That's the party that stands for free market ideals in the United States. How could Friedrich Hayek, of all people, say that he's not a conservative? But the more I read and very occasionally reread that essay over the years, it makes more and more sense to him. It makes more and more sense to me what he said, because his argument is essentially that conservatives and he refers to them as socialists. I think today we would say democratic socialists, but both democratic socialists and conservatives fear that loss of control, that the what Hayek refers to as a liberal, what we would today call a classical liberal or a libertarian, looks at the advance of knowledge and the advance of science and looks at the advance of possibilities and sees bright vistas opening before us. We can take this knowledge, we can use it, it will propel us forward. Life will be good. And the conservative looks at that and says, oh my heavens, with all of this change going on, however will we survive? We must have someone strong and authoritative, who can step in and slow everything down so that we can get a handle on it and make sure the world doesn't come flying apart at the seams. And I think a lot of what I see coming from the Democratic side has more than a whiff of such conservatism as well, of things are changing too fast, we need to put in place sensible regulations, we need to slow it down, we need to get a control over it, we need to ensure that retrograde parents don't ruin their children, we need to ensure that runaway technologies don't impoverish us all. We need to ensure that unscrupulous businessmen don't kill us all for short-term profit by leaving, say, airplanes unmaintained, and then you buy a plane ticket in the absence of regulation, and the plane crashes with 150 dead because, hey, it was cheaper to defer the maintenance for a little bit longer. And I see in both sides, the conservative and the democratic socialist, this idea to pull back the reins, put the brakes on, slow it down, make sure we have someone in charge. Whereas if I was going to sum up my own philosophy in the simplest possible terms, it would be, it's easy to be fearful. But if I've observed anything, looking at history over the last 200 plus years, it's that the disasters that have been predicted rarely come about, and the good that is in front of us is way larger than anybody at the time would have imagined. And so don't put the brakes on. Let's let that train roll, because if it keeps rolling at the pace it has been rolling at for 250 years, in 250 years, our lives are going to be so immeasurably better than they are now, we're not even going to be able to imagine it. Whereas if we put the brakes on, our lives in 250 years may very well be imaginable, and it may be something like this a little bit better. And a lot of people would consider that, hey, I'm happy with it. I would consider it a tragedy. And so I agree with Hayek now. I am not a conservative. I disagree with that sense of always needing to fear what other people are doing and needing to put the brakes on.
I don't know that this characterization of, you know, the big government liberal really fits. I mean, yes, they're constantly looking for things and trying to check and create safety barriers, if you will, say, you know, safety lanes. But I mean, there are people who agree with you. I think we're, I mean, and frequently the government is a promoter of forward thinking, even over the objection of many of its citizens, as opposed to just a force that holds people back. And my desire for people such as yourself is that rather than create an ideology out of this reverence for possibility, you observe, take part in the conversation, and apply as necessary. This ties a bit into what you were saying, but let me make a general observation as we go forward that I think really sticks with what you wanted for tonight. I am, as a writer, what I know are stories, and I think one thing that's interesting is how much I've realized the limitations of stories, not just their possibilities. You know, frequently storytellers who are trying to puff up their profession talk about how stories are the most important thing in the world, what we tell ourselves, you know, human nature so far. I'm always struck by how stories are exemplary of humanity's inability to create an artificial model of reality. To make a story that someone else can enjoy, you have to be reductive just to be understood. When you create a character, you ask questions. What is the motivation of the character? What is the character afraid of? You know, and you create this essential, this stick figure out of real, living, breathing people. You create a very simple map of this vast, detailed territory. And that is what I feel is the difference between ideology and this sort of pragmatic government-welcoming socialism that I now believe in, which is to say that libertarians and Republicans kind of propagate this view that is a story. But the truth is that it's not as simple as this calculation of what motivates a person versus what sticks. It's not as simple as... I just don't think you can draw that really deep, broad line. I mean, ultimately, I guess that's what all these political conversations about. What do you draw the line that cannot be crossed around? But, yeah, in response to, you know, this idea that we're going to hold everyone back, I think that makes for a really good dystopian story. But I don't think it accurately reflects the psychology of the people who are in charge. Or that it ever really has. From Obama on down, I think, with, in general, our presidents have not, you know, been someone you can summarize in that way. Or our leaders in general. Whatever their misjudgments. And you mentioned embracing the future and not putting the brakes on. Atomic bombs. After their discovery, the sharp clampdown by the government on, you know, certain weapons, I think, has probably benefited humanity greatly. Insofar as worldview goes, I mentioned this before. And I'd be curious as to how this, how you account for the Bible as a Christian, because my
understanding,
yeah, not in the simple, did not Jesus say, do unto others as you would have done unto you, Joe, you know, simple cudgel sense of the word, sense of, you know, biblical argument. But there is, to my knowledge, clearly a sense of communal responsibility to each other. I think libertarians tend to not see how you can prove a moral obligation, at least, or a compelling obligation, I should say, to help one another. You know, maybe morally you're in the wrong for not helping your neighbor, but not so morally wrong that a third person should come along to make you. Whereas in the Bible, there doesn't seem to be that sort of emphasis on the individual. I'm thinking of there definitely be a being a social safety net in the Old Testament when God creates the rules of Israel, which is to say that that property owners are it's demanded of property owners that they leave the leftovers from the harvest for the poor, but also that communities are murderers, not just individuals. The entire community has to atone if a murder occurs in their town. God's tendency to judge everybody in a country as opposed to just the people who did something wrong. Just in general, and maybe you disagree, but it as I see it, the Bible has a much more collectivist sense that it communicates than we have in the modern day.
Yeah, I would say as a libertarian, I get hit from both the left and the right on the question of how do you square Christianity with libertarianism? And from the right, the critique is God lays out certain moral standards. How can you possibly advocate for a society in which people are free to ignore those moral standards and live their life however they want? How can you be okay with a society in which there is gay marriage, or in which there is frequent premarital sex, or in which there is lots of abortion, or in which there is just rampant immorality of all kinds? You know, people get away with lying without any major consequences. How can you be okay with a society in which we don't step in and punish that?
Mm-hmm.
And then from the left, you get the critique of how can you be okay with not advocating for more social justice, for more social equality? Didn't the prophets have a ton to say about taking care of the least in the community and ensuring that they're well cared for? And didn't Jesus deal with just that issue himself? And I think my response to both sides is kind of the same. You see a lot of examples in Israeli law, specifically the Pentateuch. And I've just been reading through portions of Exodus recently as part of reading Robert Alter's translations, where it says exactly that about leaving parts of the field unharvested so that the poor can walk through and have something to eat. And my response to both sides would kind of be the same. That was a specific body of law for a specific group of people in a specific time. And it is absolutely an exemplar of underlying moral principles, but it is not necessarily something we are meant to enact as civil law in America in 2017. You know, we've only got 4% of the country is engaged in agricultural pursuits these days. So this idea of I have a responsibility to leave my field unplowed. What field? I don't have any crops to leave unharvested for people to nibble at the edges of when they're hungry. I do live on the outskirts of farming communities, so it's technically possible people in certain neighborhoods could walk to farms, but certainly not in my neighborhood. And same thing, I think, with moral law. We live in a much more heterogeneous society with a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds, and I don't feel a clear confidence as a Christian that I have God's authority to step in and say, this is what you shall do, and this is what the penalty shall be for not doing it, because that's always the forgotten part. If you're going to outlaw premarital sex, you're going to take somebody into court and charge them with the crime of having had premarital sex, and then it's going to come to the sentencing phase of the trial. Where in the Bible are we supposed to still drag them outside and stone them today? I don't think so, but that was kind of the penalty back then, or there was this element of you must marry the girl, there is no recourse. Are we going to go to that as a matter of law? Once you've been convicted, we frog march you to the other side of the courthouse and have a mandatory marriage ceremony. And so there's a lot of complexities as to how exactly would you implement this. And I don't feel New Testament Jesus gives me the authority and the clear direction to say, go and act thou this set of laws. And so I feel it's, if God wants to step in and judge, that's his prerogative, but it's not mine to do it. And I would say similarly on the social justice side, I have an absolute moral responsibility to be caring for, as the biblical formulation would have it, the widows and the orphans. I have an absolute responsibility, and I would argue every Christian in my church has an absolute responsibility to do that as well. And I would advocate for a strong view of church membership, that the pastor should be preaching this responsibility, and the people in the pews should be listening and obeying what is coming from the pastoral staff at the church. And so not that charity should be unenforced, but rather than being enforced by the government, it should be enforced by moral communities, whether that's Mormons, whether that's Muslims, whether that's Christians. I think each of the three major religions, Judaism as well, has all of these moral calls to take care of those who need it. And I would see that as a matter to be enforced more at that community level rather than at a government level where it's a single law that applies to everybody. But that's how I square the Bible with libertarianism. It's not that the responsibility doesn't exist. It's more a question of who is enforcing that responsibility, who is, in a sense, shunning you for not living up to that responsibility. And on the morality side, I don't have a license. Well, I would say I don't have a license to enforce a certain version of morality on you, whether that is determining who you can and can't marry, who you can and can't have sex with, or whether that's determining which charities you give to and how much you give to, and me reaching forcibly into your pocket and taking the money and giving it on your behalf if you don't. I don't think in either case the Bible grants me that level of authority over others.
So, to put it all another way, you have no trouble with the concept of monarchy as a valid form of government. You just don't think that there's a king who can do the job.
Yes. And okay. I think that's what I nibbled around the edges of. I don't remember if I ever stated that flat out at Theocrats, although I may have, but that was really the driving thought that I had while we were writing the Theocrats blog was, I've got no problem with a monarchy, but God's the only person, or Jesus if you prefer, that's eligible to fill that role, and absent that, I ain't putting my butt on that throne.
All right. That does clarify it for me. Good answer.
Yeah, I meant to give that answer earlier, and then it slipped my mind because I got distracted onto Hayek and why I'm not a conservative. So it's been good talking to you about politics. It's something we've been dancing around for so long. It's good to finally get into what some of those areas of agreement and disagreement are and how we've grown and changed over the years. So I'm glad we finally gotten to do this. I'm looking forward to talking about it more and getting into some more details. But I think that's enough for now. So good night.
Night, Joe. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you like the show, help new listeners find it by listening to Reacquainted and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Reacquainted, and give it a rating. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at FromVoxDuo on Twitter. That's at FromVoxDuo. Adam is on Twitter. His handle is at Adam Volle. That's Adam Volle. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com, and he's on Twitter as well, at JMartinDF.
Hayek is a really good example of what I'm talking about, I think, because I agree that he was a very compelling writer. I remember reading The Road to Serfdom a long time ago, and I think that a lot of those writers have really good arguments, but that they fall afoul of making a convincing case for a good map that turns out not to reflect the territory, which is to say that despite what Hayek says, there are in fact societies out there which operate on the principles that he says inevitably make you a totalitarian. I suppose you could always argue that it just hasn't happened yet, but that seems to me pretty weak.
Yeah, I would say if you're going to criticize Hayek for being unrealistic, it is apparent to me you have not read Constitution of Liberty, which I forgive because the vast majority of people have not read Constitution of Liberty. That was a surprising book when I read it because I was like, yes, Hayek, Constitution and Liberty. That's what it's all about. How do we enshrine liberty in the Constitution? And then he gets into a support for a lot more government policies than I would have expected coming from F.A. Hayek. To us like, wait, what? No, you're my hero. You're not supposed to support all of this.
I admittedly have not and do not know what particular positions Hayek supports.
I haven't read the book in a good long while, so don't ask me to tell you what he supports in it either. I just remember being very surprised as I was reading it on the airplane of this was not at all what I expected.